student media for this year has been the University of Kentucky's bizarre and perhaps unprecedented lawsuit against its own student-run newspaper, the Kentucky Colonel. That lawsuit, which recently resulted in a state court ruling enabling the university to withhold internal investigation documents about employee misconduct, is the subject that we're here to talk about on this month's SPLC podcast. Thanks for joining us, everyone. I'm Frank Lamani, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Student Press Law Center is a nonprofit advocate for the rights of student journalists everywhere to be able to gather and publish the information of their choice about social and political issues of importance to their communities. The Student Press Law Center is online at splc.org, and you can reach us through Twitter at SPLC, through email splc@splc.org, or by phone 202-785-5450. My guest is Marjorie Kirk. Marjorie Kirk is the editor-in-chief of the Kentucky Colonel, the independent student-run newspaper at the University of Kentucky. The Colonel is regularly a national award winner, including winning the Associated Collegiate Press's Pacemaker Award, designating excellence in college journalism. And Marjorie, through no fault of her own, has become one of the most highly publicized college journalists in America. She's been featured on NPR, on the front page of the New York Times, for her leadership in overseeing the newsroom during this time of turmoil and fighting for access to public records about employee misconduct at her university, a case that she actually inherited when she took over as editor-in-chief in 2016. So, Marjorie, thanks so much for joining us, and I guess I just want to give you an opportunity to set up a little bit, how did this court case come about, and what was the universe of records that the Colonel was seeking from the university, and for what purpose?
Right. Okay. So back in March, just to kind of set up the case a little bit, I was approached by a representative for two female students who had been sexually assaulted by a former professor here at the university, James Harwood. And so when they told me their story, I had originally thought this would be a one-and-done case of group of women's issue with a professor. But when we started trying to pursue the investigated report and related documents from the university, we began to see that this story is about much more than one sexual harassment and assault case. It revealed a system and what I've begun to call, not call, but think of as almost a playbook that universities have for covering up their sexual assault and harassment investigations. Because when we asked the university for the investigative report, they denied it, citing attorney-client privilege. They said that the investigative report was a student record, even though it dealt with employee disciplinary process. They said that student privacy would not allow any part of that record to be seen by the public, even though it contains information like the specific charges against a professor. It was just very arbitrary in our eyes. And so we appealed that decision to the Attorney General. And over the course of last summer, the Attorney General was reviewing our case and wanted to see the records for themselves, which is common practice across any state that has open records laws, which everyone does. And the university refused to let the Attorney General see the documents, which is something that has become characteristic of them now, but it is not a good trait. And in a lot of cases, people consider it unlawful for a public institution to refuse the Attorney General access to documents. And so the Attorney General in August of last year ruled with the Colonel and validated our appeal. They basically said that the university needed to hand over these documents to the public. And after 30 days, the Attorney General's decision becomes law unless UK appealed the decision. And so UK announced the same day that the Attorney General ruled in our favor that they would sue us. How open records law in Kentucky works is that if one party disagrees with the Attorney General, they have to sue the party that came to the Attorney General in the first place. And in this case, that's us, the student newspaper.
Yeah, this is what's so peculiar about this case, I think, and which outraged a lot of people, was the idea of the government agency as the aggressor in the case. This is so unusual and so novel to see an agency suing journalists instead of the other way around. As you're explaining, this came about because that was their way of seeking to overturn this directive by the Attorney General, which otherwise would have required them not only to disclose these records, but in their view would have set a precedent that in the future they would have to disclose records of this nature. So taking the story forward, go ahead. You get this ruling from the Attorney General, the university institutes litigation.
So the day after the University of Kentucky announced that it would sue my paper, I received a message from the same representative for the two women that I met with back in March of last year. And they basically said that they wanted to, the women had made statements and had talked to the other parties involved in the investigation, and that they wanted to hand over the documents. And so I met with the representative the next day, and they handed over the documents, and I heard the statements, and then I contacted the women through email just to verify everything and to go over specific details in the documents and to have, you know, proper discourse before I actually published anything. And so once I received the documents, so much more information came to light. There was not just two women who were assaulted by Harwood. There were three other male students who had decided not to file complaints, but had been, and who admitted in their transcripts that they did not consent to Harwood's contact with them, and that they felt extremely uncomfortable with it. And then there was another, Title IX couldn't make an official charge, but Title IX said that it was inappropriate that Harwood was trying to force the students to drink ungodly amounts of alcohol and pressure them to dance and things like that. And so there was a lot of details in those records that the women, when I initially talked to them, didn't even mention. And in addition to that, there were very clean-cut aspects of this investigation that had nothing to do with the women's side of this, that had only to do with the disciplinary process against the professor that the university did not disclose. So the fact that Harwood had two charges of sexual assault against him, the fact that he had two charges of sexual harassment, and that there were other people who told Title IX that he had questionable behavior, and that did not result in any other charges. So just the fact that there was all the information that the university was saying they couldn't release because it was basically told to them by students, that makes no sense to me. And so we think that there's, when I read those documents, I knew that these details had to be disclosed to the public. The public had to be able to evaluate, one, what kind of job did Title IX do? Two, what kind of behavior does the university have in dealing with these cases? And three, is this ethical? Is this ethical behavior for the university to have when dealing with what we would consider adjudicating criminal proceedings? We also realize that these investigations are done by lawyers for the university. There's no police involvement, and so the lawyer who is supposed to be acting in the interest of the students is actually a lawyer for the university. And it's up to the university to decide how far the thing goes and when it ends. And in the cases that we've seen come out of the university, it ends in a settlement agreement that benefits sex offenders. And so I think once we got the documents,
I should point out, just to be super clear, these are all accusations that were not adjudicated in a court of law. So I want to be fair to the accused professor here that are accusations made by one side in a dispute, accusations which to some degree he disputed, but ended up resolving by way of a consent agreement with the university that resulted in him being able to leave the university with a severance package and without a finding on his record that any adjudication had taken place, which is part of the newspaper's concern, as I understand it, that a professor or any employee of an institution could potentially enter into a confidential settlement, as you say, one negotiated by counsel for the university, not advocates for the complainants, which would result in that person being able to go forth and apply for other employment, perhaps go to another institution without any record of the seriousness of the accusations that person was facing at the time.
Right, absolutely. I mean, Harwood's record said that he resigned for family medical reasons. And when I spoke with people involved in the case a couple months after August, they mentioned seeing him at a conference trying to get jobs at other universities, overseas and in foreign countries, where they probably don't have access to our stories about him. And so just the fact that it's not going to appear on his record because of non-disclosure agreements made between him and the university, I mean, and because of this arbitrary law where the universe that is structured and seems to be only in the benefit of the university's public image, it's strange to me that they would still argue that they're acting in the best interests of victims.
Well, a really peculiar facet of this case, and one that I think a lot of folks find troubling, is the fact that over the course of the litigation, two of the complaining students actually, in effect, switched sides. Two of the complaining students, after having told the newspaper that they felt it was very important that the salient details of this case be made public for the welfare and the safety of students, then actually signed on to a brief authored by a law firm that has done a lot of work for the university, in which they supported the university's position that no record should be made public. In other words, taking the legal position that but for the benefit of the fortuitous leak that the colonel was the beneficiary of, that nothing at all about this case would ever have become publicly known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and I've mentioned this before in reference to the two women, I still think what they did in coming forward just was incredibly brave. And I think I totally trust their initial statements, but I also think that it's very easy to be influenced by the kind of contentious speech that this administration has been filtering into campus emails and just pushing down the throats of survivors and other students on our campus about what they think is how these things need to be dealt with. And so I think it's very easy to feel that pressure when your university president says, oh, we'll take care of all of this. You just sit back, enjoy this lawyer. He'll serve you pro bono. We're just here to do what we can for you. And then they go around and do what's best for them. And so I think it's very easy because, I mean, this is your university. You're supposed to be able to rely on your university. You're supposed to be able to feel like they're acting in your best interest. And so a lot of people forget that they have business interests. They have interests in their public image that supersede, in their mind, their duty to students sometimes. I mean, if they were always acting in the best interest of students, why don't they force supervisors of these employees to mention that they were subject to investigation for sexual misconduct on their separation sheets? I mean, if they were acting in the best interest of students, there's a lot more that they can do than a questionnaire before a professor is hired here that could totally be falsified. I mean, it's easy for them to make promises and gain the support of students because a lot of us take it for granted. We just assume they can't lie to us because we're paying them tuition and they're a public institution. But they have lawyers who specifically fight for their commercial and public relations interests. And so, I mean, I don't blame the women at all for joining the side of the university, but I think that what the university has done in terms of acting on their best interests has been unethical and just an abuse of their trust and the fact that they are dealing with a lot of public attention on this and looking for anyone they can turn to for help.
Well, in fact, this is not just your opinion that the university has crossed the line. The entire journalism faculty at the University of Kansas signed on to a statement asking President Capiluto to take back some of the inflammatory language he has used about the colonel and about you specifically, accusing the colonel of wanting to victimize these women and sensationalize their stories for its own self-interests. No response was ever given, and no apology has ever been forthcoming. But talk a little bit about the support that you've gotten outside of your unsupportive university administration.
So some of the most encouraging support is obviously come from the community, just here on campus, such as students, faculty here, people that are in the administration that I don't even know if the president knows about, like people in the Open Records Office have emailed me and just said, great job, keep going after this. And I'm like, wow, does he know that you know, you guys are emailing me this thing. And then past alumni. And then one of the things that's meant the most to me is, and what has spurred me on to keep doing these stories is just the number of survivors who have come to me and said, thank you for pursuing these stories. I would love to share my story with you. And I want to pursue real action against this person because I felt like the university either abused my trust in them, did not give me the justice that they led me to believe I would get, or just butchered the investigative process. We published a story last semester about a woman who had to walk campus with her rapist, even after the university found him responsible and he accepted sanctions. She ran into him on campus twice and was subject to contact from him, even after the university promised that he wouldn't be able to do that. There were just so many things that these women had felt assured of that when the promises were broken, they felt like the rug was pulled out from under them. And so I appreciate that I can give them some kind of service here by letting them tell their story. And the fact that the president of the university is now trying to skew that to make it seem like I'm here to publish is disappointing, and it shows that he has no understanding of what journalism is all about. My duty is to seek the truth and report it and to minimize harm. And regardless of what he thinks journalism is all about, if he thinks it's about airtime and making money off of ads and selling papers, then he obviously doesn't understand what kind of revenue a student newspaper makes.
Yeah. I just want, turning to the ruling that was recently handed down by the state court, regrettably for the colonel and for those interested in disclosure of these types of records, the state court bought in its entirety the argument of the university first that records about employee misconduct can be characterized as FERPA student education records just because they refer to students, even though they are not stored or maintained like student education records. The court also bought into the university's argument that these education records could not be redacted in a way that protects victim confidentiality while giving the public any meaningful information about what the accusations entailed and how they were handled. I guess from what you know of these records, does it make sense to you? Does the ruling make sense to you? And what are your thoughts about challenging it going forward?
So in relation to the judge's decision, I think he was wrong. Absolutely wrong on all counts. These records are not protected by FERPA, and they don't even reflect what FERPA was designed to protect. If you think about why FERPA became a law, it was about students' psychology, or not psychology, it was about students' psychological records, it was about their grades. It was not about disciplinary procedures that the university had. And so it makes no sense that it would be applied, one, to this kind of student involvement in the university. Two, these are employment disciplinary proceedings that these students are a part of. And while their testimony is in this, that if that testimony is absolutely considered the private document of this student, even that can be redacted. In terms of how these open records requests are filed, you can't ask for a student's name. I can't say, hey, I want all complaints that Marjorie Kirk filed. I can understand why the university would not be able to accommodate that request because that would obviously identify me. But if I were to ask for documents that were about Harwood's investigations, that does not identify a victim. In fact, they did send over some documents. The only difference between the letter that I received from the university about Harwood and the investigative report is the fact that the investigative report has details that a student said, which can be redacted. And so just the fact that a judge would think that they can't be redacted makes no sense to me. And I've seen this report. You could redact a whole page of, like, whole pages if you want, and there is still information in those documents that students and the public need to know, such as the charges that came against this person. There is no name mentioned about complainant one or complainant two in that, or how, or any characteristic or identifier of these women in those specific charges. And the fact that those would be unreleasable just because a different part of the documents contain details about the student is ridiculous. I mean, if what it takes is redacting like 100 of the 120-page report, then redact 100 pages. And then give me the details that look at just the university, just the professor, and just how these investigators conducted themselves.
And I think that we should emphasize that the Colonel has been very judicious in all of its coverage, only to release the information about victims that they themselves authorized releasing. And indeed, this is the unanimous practice of news organizations everywhere, that particularly if someone alleges a sexual battery or a sexual assault, that that person's identity will be withheld. And it's been a very time-honored practice across the industry, including among student media. And so the accusation that the Colonel was out to obtain these records for purposes of publicizing salacious or sensational personal details doesn't square with the record. I should also say that the distinction between what the university seems willing to disclose and what the Colonel would like to obtain is the substance and the nature of the employee's behavior. And you can certainly see where the substance and the nature of the accusations is important for everyone to know, including for fairness to the employee. In a different situation, you can envision where these records might be exculpatory to the employee. You know, suppose the accusations were quite minor. Suppose they were mild. Suppose this was a person who used a mild profanity at a cocktail party and was fired from a tenured professorship. Knowing the nature of the behavior might tell you that the disciplinary process is unfair to the employees as well. So disclosure could actually be healthy for the interests of everyone, the accuser and the accused alike. But unfortunately, under the state of the law now, should this ruling take hold in Kentucky, the public won't be able to find out the nature of any misconduct accusation if a student is in any way involved. I guess to that point, and by way of wrapping up our conversation, are you concerned that this ruling is going to have a spillover effect on future cases, perhaps even other educational institutions outside of your own, and has a decision been made to go further and challenge it?
Mm-hmm. It will absolutely, and already has affected the decisions of other universities. I think I've already noticed that other universities have been emboldened by the fact that UK has tried to sue its own student newspaper in this matter. I mean, you may know this, but we filed open records requests at every other public university in Kentucky. Some of them even cited the Colonel's case, the ongoing litigation, as a reason why they wouldn't want to release a decision, like why they wouldn't want to even come to a decision about the open records response, which is a violation of Kentucky open records law. But more than that, it's just, I can't even characterize it. I don't know if it's proud or prideful or just arrogant, but it's absolutely affected the behavior of other universities. in our state, and I've talked to students in other states, other student journalists and editors who have had trouble receiving the same kinds of documents from their universities. And I think it's because universities have been emboldened by this one case, and it will set the precedent for every not just every other court case, every other case that comes before a judge, because that judge, if they're in circuit court, will see this judge's ruling. But it affects every other Office of Legal Counsel's decisions because they now have a playbook. They now have this course of action that they can take that's been successful.
This further points up the importance of Congress revisiting FERPA, the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, and clarifying it to make sure that it is protecting only genuinely confidential student education records and not anything and everything that a university finds inconvenient to disclose. We'll have to leave it there, wrap up, and thank our guest, Marjorie Kirk, Editor-in-Chief of the Kentucky Kernel at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, and I should also give a little shout-out to our friends at the SPJ, the Society of Professional Journalists, both the local chapter in Kentucky and the national organization, and its president, Lynn Walsh, who have very forcefully weighed in on the side of the Kernel and have backed up that that sentiment with a pledge of financial support to assist in the appeal if one is brought as well. So thanks, Marjorie. Thanks to everybody at the Kernel, and thank you for listening to the Student Press Law Center's podcast. We have information on our website at splc.org about your right of access to public records, no matter where you live, and about how to respond to FERPA-based denials of access. We're interested in hearing your stories about any difficulty you're encountering in gaining access to public records that you think you're entitled to. Please get in touch with us anytime we can help, and we'll talk to you next month.